the impact almost winding him, and he clawed handholds in the rotted ice beyond, and then waited for a moment, recovering, before dragging himself from the crevasse. As he cleared it, a solid shape flashed past on his left, landed with a crunch, claws digging into the crusted snow. A dog. A dog? He stared at it as it scrabbled yet higher, running like a fiend from the abyss. From behind him, on the other side of the fissure, Hood heard furious barking, and looking back he saw another dog, or rather some shrunken, hair-snarled mockery of a dog, rushing up to the edge only to pull back. Don't even try. And then, with a launching leap, the horrid creature was sailing through the air. Not far enough. Hood cursed as jaws clamped on his left foot, the teeth punching through the rotted leathers of his boot. Hissing in pain, he swung his leg round, kicked to shake off the snarling creature. He caught a blurred glimpse of its horrid face, like a rat that had been slammed headfirst into a wall, as it shot past him on the trail of the bigger animal. He glared after it for a moment, and then the jaghut picked himself up and resumed climbing, with a limp. She had been hurt by the fall, Stormy saw, watching as she laboriously made her way back up the stairs. Her left arm was clearly broken, the shoulder dislocated, skin scraped off where she had struck the unyielding bedrock. Had they been a dozen steps higher, she would be dead now. The Marine swore under his breath, twisted round to glare up at Gessler. He'd reached some kind of rest platform, maybe 25 steps below the summit. What's he doing? Taking a damned breather? There's no time for that, you idiot! Go! I will kill you! At the shriek, Stormy looked back down, 10 steps between him and Sin. Her face was lifted towards him, made demonic by hatred and rage. A billowing gust of scorching heat rushed up to buffet him. He backed up the steps, 2, 3, 5. She climbed closer. The air ignited around Sin, red and orange flames white hot where her body had been. Yet from that raging incandescent core, he could still see her eyes, fixed on him. Gods below, she is not even human. Was she ever human? What manner of creature is this? The fire roared words. I will kill you. No one touches me. I will burn you. I will burn all who touch me. I will burn you all. You will know what it is to hurt. You said you wanted the fire inside me. You said you would kiss it. But you lied. You hurt me. You hurt me. You wanted the fire in me. You shall have it. The flames exploded out from her, stormed up the steps and engulfed Stormy. He howled. This was not Tellus. This burned. This reached for him, took hold of him, bursting and cracking open his skin, tearing into his flesh, burrowing to clutch at his very bones. His screams vanished, though his mouth remained open, his head thrown back in the stunning agony of the fire. His lungs were burned, useless, his eyes erupted and boiled away. He felt her drawing closer, knew she was directly below him now. He could feel the stone steps against his back, could feel his body melting, pouring down as if molten. Her hand closed on one ankle, crushed it to dust. But he had been waiting for that touch. He had been holding on, to what he knew not, and with a silent sob that seemed to tear his soul in half, Stormy threw himself forward, closed what remained of his arms about her. A shriek filled his skull, and then they were falling. Not like the first time. He'd drawn her almost half the way to the top, and he could feel her body inside that fire, or thought he could. They plummeted. Guess, take this. All I could... He was dead before they struck, but enough of Stormy's corpse remained to hammer Sin against the bedrock, though it was not needed. The impact split her skull, sent burning meat, blood, and flesh spraying out to sizzle on the superheated rock. Her spine broke in 4 places, her ribs buckled and folded under her back, splintered ends driving up through her lungs and heart. The raging fires then closed on her, consuming every last shred, before dying in flickering puddles on the bedrock. Gessler could not keep the tears from his eyes as he climbed the last few steps. He would not look down, would not surrender to that, knowing it would break him. The fury of heat that had lifted up around him moments earlier was now gone.
"He's done it. Somehow. He's killed her. But he didn't make it. I feel it. A hole carved out of my soul. Beloved brother, you are gone. I should have ordered you to stay behind. Not that you ever listened to orders. That was always your problem, Stormy. That was... Oh, gods, take me!"
He pulled himself onto the summit, rolled onto his back, staring up at the chaotic sky, smoke, the jade strangers, a day dying to darkness. And then, gasping, numbed, Gessler pushed himself onto his feet. Straightening, he looked across the flat expanse. A female Forkrell Asael stood facing him, young, almost incandescent with power. Behind her was a mass of bone chains heaped over something that pulsed with carmine light, the heart of the crippled god.
"Where is your sword?" the Forkrell Asael demanded. "Or do you think you can best me with just your hands?"
"My hands. I broke a man's nose once," Gessler said, advancing on her. She sneered.
"It is too late, human. Your god's death assured that. It was your god, wasn't it? By your own prayers you summoned it to its execution. By your own prayers you lost your war, human. How does that feel? Should you not kneel before me?"
Her words had slowed him, then halted him still 3 paces from her. He could feel the last remnants of his strength draining away.
"There is no magic in her voice. None we would call so, anyway. No, the only power in her voice resides in the truth she speaks. I killed Fenrir."
"When this day began," continued the Forkrell Asael, "I was an old woman, frail and bent. You could have pushed me over with a nudge then. Look at you, after all, a soldier, a veteran of many battles, many wars. I know this not by the scars you bear, but by the endless losses in your eyes."
"Losses? Yes, so many losses."
The woman gestured behind her.
"There can be an end to the pain, soldier, if you so desire. I can grant you that, Sip."
I need a way out," said Gessler.
She nodded.
"I understand, soldier. Shall I give it to you, that way out?"
"Yes."
She cocked her head, her forehead seeming to flinch inward momentarily, as if about to vertically fold in half.
"I sense no duplicity in you. That is good. I am indeed become your salvation."
"Yes," he replied. "Lead me from here, Pure."
She raised one bony, long-fingered hand, reaching for his brow. His fist was a blur. It smashed into her face. Bones snapped. The Forkrell Asael reeled back, breath spraying from a crushed nose, and that fold dividing her face was deeply creased. Shaking her head, she straightened. Gessler knew he was fast, but she was faster. She blocked his second punch and countered. The blow broke his left shoulder, threw him 6 paces back. He landed hard, skidded, and then rolled onto his broken shoulder. The agony that ripped through him took with it all of his strength, his will. Stunned, helpless, he heard her advance. A strange skittering sound, and then the sound of 2 bodies colliding. He heard her stumble, heard bestial snarling. Gessler forced himself onto his side, looked across. Bent had struck the Forkrell Asael from one side, with enough force to drive her to one knee. The cattle dog's jaws had closed on the side of her face, its canines tearing through flesh and bone. One eye was already gone, a cheekbone pulled away, spat out and lying on the blood-stained stone. He saw her reach round even as she staggered upright and one hand closed on Bent's throat. She dragged the beast from the ruin of her face. The cattle dog, held out at the end of that long, muscled arm, struggled desperately in her choking grip.
No!
Somehow Gessler found his feet, and then he was rushing her. Her lone eye locked with his glare, and she smiled. He saw her flexing her free arm, drawing it back to await him. He could block that blow, he could try to take her down, but Bent was dying. She was crushing his throat.
No!
In a flash, he saw a battlefield filled with corpses, saw Truth dragging a limp dog free of the bodies. He heard the lad's shout of surprise, and then that look in his eyes, so hopeful, so young.
No!
Ignoring her fist, even as it shot out for his head, Gessler sent his own blow, not into her face, but into the shoulder of the arm holding the dog. The hardest punch he ever threw. Crushing impacts, and then? The soldier's punch spun Reverence round, the stunning power behind it shattering her shoulder, even as her own blow connected with his forehead, splitting it, snapping his head back and breaking the vertebrae of his neck. He was dead before he struck the ground. But her right arm was useless, and she sagged to one knee as the dog pulled itself free of her numbed hand.
No matter. I will kill it next. A moment to push past this pain, to clear my thoughts.
Bent kicked free, stumbled away. Air filled his lungs. Life flooded back into him. In his mind, a red mist, yearning need, and nothing else. Head lifting, the beast turned back to his master's enemy. But his master was lying so still, so emptied of all life. The Wiccan cattle dog was not bred for its voice. It rarely barked and never howled. Yet the cry that now came from Bent could have awakened the wolf gods themselves. And the white-skinned woman straightened then and laughed, slowly turning to face the beast. Bent gathered his legs beneath him, the scarred nightmare of his muzzle peeled back, revealing misshapen, jagged fangs. And then someone stepped past him. Hood advanced on the Forkrell Asael even as she was turning towards the dog. When she saw him, she cried out, took a step back. He closed. Her left fist snapped out, but he caught it one-handed, crushed both wrist bones. She screamed. The jaghut then reversed his grip on that wrist and added his other hand. With a savage lunge, he whirled her off her feet, slammed her body down on the stone. Yelping, the dog backed away. But Hood was not yet done with her. He swung her up again, spun, and once more hammered her onto the stone.
I have had!
The jaghut roared, and into the air she went again, and down once more.
Enough!
With a sob, the crushed, broken body was yanked from the ground again.
Of your justice!
As the stranger dropped the limp arm he still held, Bent crawled over to his master's side. He lay down, settling his heavy head across the man's chest. The stranger looked at him, but said nothing. Bent showed his teeth to make his claim clear. He is mine. The heavy thud of wings made Hood turn round, to see a Shigal assassin descend to the great altar. Half crouched, yet still towering over the jaghut, it regarded him with cold eyes. Hood glanced over at the heart of the crippled god. The Pure's ancestral chains were gone, destroyed with her own death. The heart was finally free, lying pulsing feebly in a pool of blood. The smaller dog arrived, rushing over to worry at the torn face of the Forkrell Asael. Grunting, Hood gestured towards the heart, and then turned away to stare out over the lands to the west. Beyond the fields heaped with corpses, beyond the armies now gathered, virtually motionless with exhaustion, and now figures were climbing the stairs. He heard the winged assassin lifting into the air, and he knew that the creature now clutched that pathetic heart. The Shigal's shadow slipped over the jaghut, and then he could see it rising yet higher, winging towards the setting sun. Then his gaze fell once more, looking down on the devastation below.
I once sat upon the throne of death. I once greeted all who must in the end surrender, with skeletal hands, with a face of skin and bone hidden in darkness. How many battlefields have I walked? Must I walk one more? But this time they are the ones who have left. Guardians of the gate, will you tell all these who come to you now that it all meant nothing? Or have you something to give them, something more than I ever could?
Others had arrived. He heard the wailing of a woman in grief, and was reminded that there was, in truth, no sadder sound in all the worlds. Bitterspring, Lera Epar of the Imas, lay propped up against cold bodies. Her wound had been bandaged, the flow of blood staunched. Around her the survivors were moving about, many simply wandering, while others stood motionless, heads lowered, scanning the ground for familiar faces. She saw her kin. She saw Thel Akai. She saw Kachain Chemal and Jagat. And she watched Onos Tulan leaving them all, stumbling northward onto the stretch of flat land edging the walled port city that had once been the capital of the Forkral Asael Empire. None of the Imas called after him. None asked where he was going. He was the first sword, but so too was he a man. She tilted her head back, studied the procession up the scalded stone stairs of the spire. Prince Bryce Bedict, Aranict, Queen Abrastel, Spax of the Gilk Bargast, the priest-woman of the Kachain Chemal. The 11 remaining Jaghut were also making their way in that direction.
It is done, then. It must be done. There is peace now. It must be peace. What other name for this terrible silence?
More rain began to fall as the day's light slowly died. But this rain was pure and clear. She closed her eyes and let it rinse clean her face. Onos Tulan walked past the city, out onto a barren headland of gorse and heather. The day's light was fast fading, but he was indifferent to that, and the ground underfoot, which had been soaked in blood, was now slick with simple rain. The sun spread gold across the western horizon. And then in the distance he saw three figures, and Onos Tulan's eyes narrowed. Like him, they seemed to be wandering, like him, lost in the world. He drew closer. The sword in his right hand, thick with gore, but now showing its gleaming stone as the rain washed down its length, then fell to the ground, and he was running. His heart seemed to swell in his chest, seemed to grow too large for the bone cage holding it. When they saw him, he heard childish cries, and now they were rushing towards him, the girl not carrying the boy, winging ahead. All three were crying as they ran to meet him. He fell to his knees to take them into his arms. Words were tumbling from the twins, a savior, an all-warrior they had lost in the storm, a witch who had stolen them, their escape, and he had promised them he would find them. But he never did, and... Lifting his gaze, still facing into the north, Onos Tulan then saw something else. A vague shape that appeared to be sitting on the ground, curled over. He rose, the girls reaching up to take his arms, the boy clinging to one shin. And then he moved forward, taking them all with him. When the boy complained, Story picked him up in her arms. But Onos Tulan walked on, his steps coming faster and faster. It was not possible. It was... And then, once more, he was running. She must have heard his approach, for she looked up and then over and sat watching him rushing towards her. He almost fell against her, his arms wrapping tight round her, lifting her with his embrace. Hetan gasped.
Husband, I have missed you. I don't know where I am. I don't know what has happened.
Nothing has happened, he whispered, as the children screamed behind them.
Onos, my toes.
What?
I have someone else's toes, husband. I swear it.
The children collided with them. In the distance ahead, on a faint rise of land, Onos Tulan saw a figure seated on a horse. The darkness was taking the vision, dissolving it before his eyes, and then he saw it raise one hand. Straightening, Onos Tulan did the same.
I see you, my brother. I see you.
When at last the light left the rise of land, the vision faded from his eyes. Chapter 24. I have heard voices thick with sorrow. I have seen faces crumble with grief. I have beheld broken men rise to stand, and witnessed women walk from small graves. Yet now you would speak of weakness, of failings worth nothing but scorn. You would show all the sides of your fear, brazen as trophies in the empty shell of conquest. But what have you won when the night draws close to make stern your resolve among these shadows, when at last we are done with the world, when we neither stand nor fall nor wake from stillness, and the silent unknowing waits for us? I have heard my voice thick with sorrow. I have felt my face crumble with grief. I have broken and turned away from graves, and I have grasped tight this hand of weakness, and walked in the company of familiar failings. Scorn lies in the dust and in the distance behind. Every trophy fades from sight. The night lies ahead, drawing me into its close. For when I am done with this world, in the unknowing I will listen for the silence, to await what is to come. And should you seek more, find me in this place before the rising dawn. Journey's Resolution, Fisher Kel'Tath. Banaskar remembered how she had stood, the sword in its scabbard lying on the map table before her. A single oil lamp had bled weak light and weaker shadows in the confines of the tent. The air was close and damp, and it settled on things like newborn skin. A short time earlier, she had spoken to Lostari Yil with her back to that weapon, and Banaskar did not know if Tavare had used those words before, and the question of that gnawed at him in strange, mysterious ways. If they had been words oft repeated by the adjunct, then what tragic truths did that reveal about her? But if she'd not said them before, not ever, then why had he heard them as if they were echoes, rebounding from some place far away and long ago? Lostara had been to see Hanavat, to share in the gift of the son that had been born. The captain's eyes had been red from weeping, and Banaskar understood the losses these women were now facing, the futures about to be torn away from them. He should not have been there. He should not have heard the adjunct speak. It is not enough to wish for a better world for the children. It is not enough to shield them with ease and comfort. Lostari Yil, if we do not sacrifice our own ease, our own comfort, to make the future's world a better one, then we curse our own children. We leave them a misery they do not deserve. We leave them a host of lessons unearned. I am no mother, but I need only look at Hanavat to find the strength I need. The words were seared into his memory. In the voice of a childless woman, they left him more shaken, more distraught than he perhaps would otherwise have been. Was this what they were fighting for? Only one among a host of reasons, surely. And in truth, he could not quite see how this path they'd chosen could serve such aspirations. He did not doubt the nobility of the adjunct's motivations, nor even the raw compassion so driving her to seek what was, in most eyes, virtually impossible. But there was something else here, something still hidden. How many great compassions arose from a dark source, a private place of secret failings? After she had sent Lostara away, Tavare had turned once more to the sword, and after a time Banaskar had stirred from his seat on the war gear chest, risen and walked to her side.
I have stopped running, adjunct.
She was silent, her eyes fixed on the weapon in its battered, scratched scabbard.
I wish to thank you for that. Proof, he added with a sour smile, of your gifts of achieving the impossible.
Priest, she said, the Chalmanaga, the snake, that was a manifestation of Derek, was it not? He found himself unable to meet her eyes, but managed a simple shrug.
I think so. For a time, her children were lost, in her eyes anyway, and that made her just as lost, I suppose. Together, they needed to find their way.
Those details do not interest me, she said, tone hardening. Beniscar, tell me, what does she want? Why is she so determined to be here? Will she seek to oppose me?
Why would you think I have answers to those questions, adjunct?
Because she never left you either. She needed at least one of her worshippers to live on, and for some unknown reason she chose you. He wanted to sit down again, anywhere, maybe even on the floor.
Adjunct, it is said that a worm finding itself in a puddle of ale will get drunk and then drown. I've often thought about that, and I admit I've come to suspect that any puddle will do, and getting drunk has nothing to do with it. The damned things drown anyway. And yet, oddly enough, without any puddles, the worms don't show up at all.
We have left the new lake behind us, priest. No one drowned, not even you.
They're just children now.
I know. Beniscar sighed, nodded down at the sword.
She will protect it, adjunct.
He heard her breath catch, and then... But that might well kill her. He nodded, not trusting himself to speak. Are you certain of this, Demidrek?
Demi, gods below, adjunct. Are you a student of theology as well? Teishren was...
As the last surviving priest of the Worm of Autumn, the honorific belongs to you, Beniscar.
Fine, but where are the gold-stitched robes and the gaudy rings?
An aide entered behind them, coughed, and then said, Adjunct, three horses are saddled and waiting outside. Thank you. Suddenly Beniscar was chilled, his hands cold and stiff, as if he'd left them in buckets of ice water.
Adjunct, we do not know if the heart will be freed. If you...
They will succeed, Demidrek. Your own god clearly believes that.
Wrong.
She was startled to silence.
It's simpler than that, adjunct.
Beniscar went on, the words tasting of ashes.
Derek doesn't care if the crippled god is whole or not. If he's little more than a gibbering fool, or a gutted body with a huge hole in his chest, it doesn't matter. Whatever you have of him, she wants it gone.
Then, her eyes narrowed.
Correct. Listen to her last, Demidrek, because he knows when his god has lost all faith.
They won't fail,
Tavare whispered, eyes once more on the sword.
And if the perish betray them, what then?
But she was shaking her head.
You don't understand.
All our putative allies, adjunct. Are they strong enough, willful enough, stubborn enough? When the bodies start falling, when the blood starts flowing, listen to me, Tavare. We have to weigh what we do, all that we do here, on the likelihood of their failing.
I will not.
Do you think I have no respect for Prince Bryce Bedict or Queen Abrastal? But, adjunct, they are striking where Akrast Corvalane is at its strongest, where the most powerful of the Fokrul Asael will be found. Has it not once occurred to you that your allies won't be enough?
But she was shaking her head, and Beniscar felt a flash of fury.
Will you be nothing more than a child, hands over your ears because you don't like hearing what I have to say?
You do not yet understand, Demidrek. Nor, it seems, does your god.
So tell me then. Explain it to me. How in Hood's name can you be so sure?
The Kachain,
adjunct. This is the last gasp of those damned lizards. It doesn't matter who seems to be commanding them either. The matron commands. The matron must command. If she sees too many of her children dying, she will withdraw. She has to, for the very survival of her kind.
They are led by Gessler and Stormy Beneskar.
Gods below! Just how much faith have you placed in the efforts of two demoted marines?
She met his eyes unflinching. All that I need to. Now you have indulged your moment of doubt, I trust. It is time to leave. He studied her for a moment longer, and then felt the tension draining from him, managed a lopsided smile.
I am Demidrek to the Worm of Autumn, adjunct. Perhaps she hears you through me. Perhaps in the end we can teach Drek a lesson in faith.
Better, she snapped, picking up the sword. They stepped outside. The three horses were waiting, two saddles as yet unfilled. Slouched in the third one, Beneskar looked up, nodded in greeting.
Captain?
Priest, Fiddler replied. He and the adjunct swiftly mounted up, the scrawny animals shifting beneath them, and then the three of them swung away, rode out from the Malazan encampment on the grassy plain, riding northwest. There had been few words on that journey. They rode through the night, alternating between canter and trot. The western horizon was lit on occasion with lurid lightning, the flashes stained red, but overhead the jade strangers commanded the night sky, bright enough to expunge the stars, and the rolling grasslands around them bore a hue of healthy green the day's light would reveal as false. There had been no rain in this place for years, and the hoofs of their horses kicked up broken blades of grass like scythes. When they came in sight of a lone rise that dominated all the others, the adjunct angled her horse towards it. The lesser hills they crossed as they drew closer all bore signs of ancient camps, boulders left in ragged rings to mark where the sides of teepees had been anchored down. 1,000 paces to the northwest, the land dropped down into a broad, shallow valley, and its far slope was marked by long, curving stretches of rocks and boulders, forming lines, blinds, and runs for herd beasts now long gone, as vanished as the hunters who had preyed upon them. Beneskar could feel the desolation of this place, like an itch under his skin, a crawling unease of mortality.
It all passes. All our ways of doing things, seeing things, all these lost ways of living. And yet, could I step back into that age, could I stand unseen among these people, I would be no different, no different inside. Gods, could I explain this even to myself, I might someday make a claim to wisdom. Our worlds are so small. They only feel endless because our minds can gather thousands of them all at once. But if we stop moving, if we hold to one place, if we draw breath and look around, each one is the same, barring a few details. Lost ages are neither more nor less profound than the one we live in right now. We think it's all some kind of forward momentum, endless leaving behind and reaching towards. But the truth is, wherever we find ourselves, with all its shiny gifts, we do little more than walk in circles. The thought makes me want to weep.
They drew rein at the base of the hill. The sides were uneven, with projections of rust-stained bedrock pushing up through the thin skin of earth, the stone cracked and fissured by untold centuries of frost and heat. Closer to the summit was a crowded chaos of yellow-white dolomite boulders, their softer surfaces pecked and carved with otherworldly scenes and geometric patterns. Spikewood and some kind of prairie rose bushes, skeletal now and threatening with thorns, filled the spaces between the boulders. The adjunct dismounted, drawing off her leather gloves.
Captain?
Aye, he replied. It will do.
When Fiddler slipped down from his horse, Beneskar followed suit. The adjunct in the lead, they ascended the hillside, now closer to the rotted outcrops, Banaskar saw bleached fragments of human bone trapped in cracks and crevasses, or heaped on ledges and in niches. On the narrow, winding tracks between the upthrust bedrock, his boots crunched on beads made from polished nuts, and the ground was littered with the withered remnants of woven baskets. Reaching the summit, they saw that the dolomite boulders formed a rough ring, perhaps 10 paces across, with the center area more or less level. When the adjunct walked between 2 boulders and stepped into the clearing, her lead boot skidded and she lurched back. Righting herself, she looked down, and then crouched to pick something up. Banaskar reached her side. She was holding a spear point made from chipped flint, almost dagger length, and the priest now saw that the entire stretch of level ground was carpeted in thousands of similar spear points.
"Left here, all unbroken," muttered Banaskar as Fiddler joined them. "Why, I wonder?"
The captain grunted.
"Never could figure out holy sites. Still, those tools are beautifully made. Even an imas would be impressed." "Here is my guess," Banaskar said. "They discovered the technology that was too successful. Ended up killing every animal they saw until none were left. Why? Because we are all equally stupid. Just as short-sighted, 20,000 years ago or tomorrow makes no difference. And the seduction of slaughter is like a fever. When they finally realized what they'd done, when they all began starving, they blamed their tools. And yet," he glanced across at Fiddler, "even to this day we think efficiency is a good thing."
Fiddler sighed. "I sometimes think we only invented war when we ran out of animals to kill." Dropping the spear point, it broke in half when it struck the lair of its kin. The adjunct stepped forward. Stone snapped with every stride. When she was at the very center, she turned to face them.
"This is not a matter of sacredness," she said. "There is nothing worth worshipping in this place, except perhaps a past that can never again exist. And the name for that is nostalgia. I'm not a believer in innocence either."
"Then why here?" Banaskar asked. But it was Fiddler who answered. "Because it is defendable, priest."
"Demidrek?"
Tavare asked, one hand now on the grip of her sword. He looked round, stepped over to see one of the dolomite boulders. Swirling patterns, grooves flowing like hair. Demonic, vaguely human figures, faces composed of staring eyes and open mouths filled with sharp teeth. He sighed, looked back at the adjunct, and then nodded.
"She can, I don't know, wrap herself round the base of this hill, like a dragon worm of legend, I suppose."
"To what end, Demidrek?"
"Containment."
"For how long?"
"Until she dies."
He shrugged. He saw her studying him for a moment longer, and then the adjunct Tavare drew out her Ototaral sword. The rust-colored blade seemed to blaze in Banaskar's eyes, and he staggered back a step. Nearby, Fiddler swore under his breath.
"Adjunct, it's awake." "And," whispered Banaskar, "it shall summon."
Tavare kicked a space clear on the ground with one boot, and then set the sword's tip against the earth. She pushed down, using all of her weight. The blade slid, as if through sand, down to half its length. Stepping back, the adjunct seemed to reel. Banaskar and Fiddler reached her at the same time, taking her weight.
"Gods, there is so little left of her, bones and skin."
She slumped unconscious in their arms.
"Here," grunted Fiddler, "let's drag her back. Find somewhere clear."
"No," said Banaskar. "I will carry her down to the horses."
"Right, I'll go ahead. Get her some water."
Banaskar had picked Tavare up.
"Fiddler."
"Aye," he growled, "like a starved child under that armor. When she comes round, priest, we're making her eat."
The soldier might as well have said, "We're laying siege to the moon," and been absolutely convinced that he would do just that, and then take the damned thing down in ruin and flames.
"It's how a soldier thinks, at least this one, this damned marine."
Saying nothing, he followed Fiddler down the narrow, twisting track. She had been laid down on a threadbare saddle blanket. Banniscar had unstrapped and removed her helm, and rested her head on the worn saddle they'd pulled from the adjunct's horse. Off to one side, Fiddler was splintering wood and building a small fire. Taking a waterskin, the priest soaked a bundle of bandages from the sapper's kit bag and began tenderly wiping the sweat and grime from Tavare's brow and those so plain features. With her eyes closed, he saw the child she had once been, serious, determined, impatient to grow up. But the face was gaunter than it should have been, too old, too worn down. He brushed tendrils of damp, lank hair from her forehead, then glanced over at Fiddler.
Is it just exhaustion, do you? Gods below, Fiddler!
The man was breaking up his deck of dragons, using his knife to split each card. He paused, looked across at the priest.
She's getting a cooked meal.
Banniscar watched as the sapper fed the splinters into the fire. The paints filled the flames with strange colors.
You don't expect to survive, do you?
Even if I do, I'm done with this, all of it.
You couldn't retire from soldiering even if you wanted to.
Really? Just watch me.
What will you do? Buy a farm? Start growing vegetables?
Gods no. Too much work. Never could figure out soldiers saying they'd do that once they buried their swords. Earth grows what it wants to grow. Spending the rest of your life fighting it is just another damned war.
Right then. Get drunk. Tell old stories in some foul tavern.
Like you was doing back in Mala's city.
Banniscar's smile was wry.
I was about to advise against it, Captain. Maybe it sounds good from here, being able to live every moment without purpose, emptied of all pressure. But take it from me, you'd do just as well topping yourself. It's quicker and probably a lot less miserable.
Fiddler poured some water into a pot and then set it on the flames. He began dropping shreds of dried meat into it.
Nah, nothing so wasteful. Thought I'd take up fishing.
Never figured you for a man of the seas.
You mean like in a boat with lines and nets? Out on the waves and o'er the deeps?
No, not that kind of fishing, priest. Sounds like work to me, and dangerous besides. No, I'll stay ashore. I'm thinking hobby, not livelihood.
Glancing down at Tavare's lined face, Banniscar sighed.
We should all live a life of hobbies, doing only what gives us pleasure, only what rewards us in secret, private ways.
Wise words, priest. You're just filled with surprises tonight, aren't you?
When Banniscar shot the man a look, he saw his faint grin and the tension eased out from him. He grunted.
I went into the priesthood looking for wisdom, and only then did I realize I'd gone in precisely the wrong direction.
Piety not all it's made out to be, then?
Is soldiering, Fiddler?
The man slowly settled back, stirring with his knife blade.
Had a friend once, tried warning an eager little boy away from the soldier's life.
And did your friend succeed?
Doesn't matter if he did or didn't, that's not the point.
So what is the point, then?
You can't steer anyone away from the path they're going to take. You can show 'em that there's plenty of other paths, you can do that much, but past that, they'll go where they go.
Your friend should have scared that boy rigid. That might have worked.
Fiddler shook his head.
Can't feel someone else's terror either, Banniscar. We only know terror for what it is when it looks us dead in the eye.
There was a sigh from Tavare, and the priest looked down.
You fainted, adjunct. The sword, it's done.
She struggled to sit up.
Then we must leave.
We will, adjunct, Fiddler said, but first we eat.
Tavare pushed Banniscar's hands away and struggled upright.
You damned fool! Do you know who that sword is summoning?
Aye, just burned that card as it happens.
Banniscar almost felt the adjunct's shock, like a jolt of sparks snapping through the air between them. The priest snorted.
You've gone and made her speechless, Sapper.
Good. Can't eat and talk at the same time. Come over here, adjunct, else me and the priest will have to hold you and force this stew down your throat. Won't do any good if you go and collapse at the wrong moment, will it?
You should not have done that, fiddler.
Relax, the man replied, tapping his satchel. Saved one house, the only one that means anything to us now.
Ours is a house still divided, Captain.
The king in chains? Never mind him. The fool's too busy undermining the throne he happens to be sitting on, and the knight is with us.
Are you certain?
I am. Be at ease on that count.
When that god manifests, fiddler, it will be upon a battlefield. Thousands of souls will feed its shaping. We are speaking of a god of war. When it comes, it could well fill half the sky.
Fiddler glanced across at Banaskar, and then he shrugged. Beware the vow of a Toblakai. And then, with a half-smile, he filled a tin bowl with stew and handed it up to the adjunct. Eat, dear consort. The rest are with us. Reaver, Fool, the Seven, Leper. And his gaze fell for a moment with that title, before he looked back up, grinned over at Banaskar. Cripple.
Cripple? Oh, well, yes. Been staring me in the face all this time, I suppose. Been thinking it was terror, that old mirror reflection. And surprise, it was.
While they ate, Banaskar's memories wandered back to the moment in her tent and her words with Lostara, and all that followed.
Children, gather close. Your mother's days are fraught now. She needs you. She needs us all.
Glancing up, he saw Tavare studying him. Banaskar, was it you who removed my helm, wiped down my face and combed through my hair? His gaze dropped.
Yes, adjunct.
She made an odd sound and then said, I am sorry. I must have looked a mess.
Oh, Tavare.
Fiddler rose suddenly and said in a gruff voice, I'll saddle your horse, adjunct. Hedge watched as the three riders rode back into the camp.
A verdict. Distribute the munitions.
The alchemist turned and in a startled voice asked,
All of them?
All of them. And get them kitted out. Water, a little food, armor and weapons and nothing else.
I'll go talk to the sergeants.
Nodding, Hedge set off. He found Fiddler on foot just outside the adjunct's tent. The man was alone, standing looking down at the ground.
We're coming with you,
Hedge said. Fiddler looked up, scowled.
No, you're not. The bridge burners are coming with you. Nothing you can do about it.
It's all over with, Hedge. Just leave it alone. And he turned away. But Hedge reached out, pulled the man round.
I already asked the adjunct. I did it last night, once I figured out what was going on. You need me there, Fiddler. You just don't know it yet. You don't know the half of it. But you'll just have to trust me on this. You need me there.
Fiddler stepped close, his face dark. Why? Why the fuck do I? Passing soldiers paused, turned to stare.
You just do. If you don't, I swear this, Fid, I swear it, you'll spend the rest of your days poisoned with regret. Listen to me. It's not only us. Can't you see that? You need the bridge burners.
Fiddler pushed him back with both hands, staggering Hedge.
They're not bridge burners. It's not just a fucking name. You can't just pick up any old useless fools and call them bridge burners. Why not?
Hedge retorted.
It's what we were, wasn't it? At the beginning? Young and wide-eyed, stupid, and wanting to be better than we were.
He waved an arm to take in the camp.
No different from these bone hunters. Don't you see that? Don't follow me. You're not listening. I went through, I came back. I have no choice, damn you.
There were tears glistening in Fiddler's eyes.
Just don't.
Hedge shook his head.
I told you, no choice.
None at all.
When Fiddler pushed past him, Hedge let him go. He looked round, scowled.
It's almost noon. Go eat something, you slack-jawed bastards.
Then he headed back for his company's camp.
Fiddler cut between two staff tents and made it halfway down before he stopped and slowly sank to one knee, his hands over his face. As tears broke loose, shudders drove through him, wave upon wave.
We're going to die. Can't he see that? I can't lose him again. I just can't.
He could still feel Hedge's shoulders where he'd pushed him and see the hurt look on the man's face.
No, don't.
His hands stung. His hands burned. He balled them into fists, head hanging, forcing himself to draw deep breaths, forcing all the rawness away, and with it the terrible anguish that threatened to break him, crush him down. He needed to go to his soldiers now. The sergeants would have them ready, waiting, marines and heavies, the last of both.
One more thing to do, and then we'll be done. All of it, finished. God's Hedge, we should have died in the tunnels. So much easier, so much quicker. No time to grieve, no time for the scars to get so thick it's almost impossible to feel anything at all. And then you showed up and tore them all open again. Whiskey Jack, Callum, Trotz, they're gone. Why didn't you stay there with them? Why couldn't you just have waited for me?
Still the tears streamed down his face, soaking his beard. He could barely see the matted dead grasses beneath him.
End this. One more thing to do. They'll try and stop us. They have to. We need to be ready for them. I need to be a captain, the one in charge, the one to tell my soldiers where to die.
Wiping at his face, he slowly straightened.
Gods, he muttered. First the adjunct, and now this.
He sighed.
Let's just call it a bad day and be done with it. Ready, Fid? Ready for them? You'd better be.
He set out. There was glory in pissing, Korab decided, as he watched the stream curve out and make that familiar but unique sound as it hit the ground.
Doesn't look like you need both hands for that, Smiles observed from where she sat nearby.
Today I shall even look upon you with sympathy, he replied, finishing up and then spitting on his hands to clean them.
Sympathy? What am I, a lame dog?
Sitting leaning against his pack, Bottle laughed, earning a dark look from Smiles.
We are going somewhere to fight, Korab said, turning to face her and the others sitting on the ground beyond. Today, you are all my family.
Explains the sympathy, Korik muttered.
And I will stand at your side, Korik of the Seti, Korab said.
Smiles snorted.
To what? Keep him from running?
No, because this time he will stand with us. He will be a soldier again.
There was a long moment of silence from the gathered squad, and then Korik rose and walked a short distance away.
There's demons crouched in his brain, Cuttle said under his breath. All that whispering must be driving him mad.
Here comes the sergeant, Korab said. It's time.
He went to his kit bag, checked the straps once again, picking up the crossbow and admiring it for a moment before tying it on to the satchel. He recounted the quarrels and was satisfied to find that they still numbered 12.
Load up, Tar said when he arrived. We're headed northwest.
That's damn near back the way we came, said Smiles. How far? If I even come within sight of that desert, I'll slit my own throat.
It's a big lake now, Smiles,
Bottle pointed out. Tar said,
should be there by noon tomorrow, or so the captain says. Take food for 2 days and as much water as you can carry.
Korab scratched at the beard covering his jaw.
Sergeant, the regulars are getting ready to break camp, too.
They're going east, Corporal.
When do we rendezvous?
But the sergeant's only reply was a sharp glance, and then he went to his own gear. Smiles edged up close to Korab.
Should have used that thing for more than just pissing, Corporal,
and now it's too late.
Oh, I get it. We're not coming back. Then we march to glory.
Hood's breath, Smiles sighed.
But he caught a look on her face, quickly hidden.
She is afraid. She is so young. And you, Smiles, shall stand on my other side.
Did she almost sag towards him then? He could not be sure, and she kept her face down, turned away as she worked on her satchel.
You have let your hair grow long, he said. It makes you almost pretty.
Cuttle edged close.
You really don't know when to keep your mouth shut, do you, Korab?
Form up, Tar said. We're in the lead to start.
Cuttle met his sergeant's eyes and gave a faint nod. Tar turned and looked ahead to where Fiddler waited. The captain looked ill, but he held Tar's gaze without expression, and then Fiddler swung round and set off. Their march would take them through the entire camp of regulars, down the central widest avenue between the uneven rows of tents, awnings, and blinds. The sapper looked up at the sky, then back down again. Those blazing slashes seemed closer than ever, unnerving him. Cuttle waved the others in their squad forward, then glanced back to see Balm leading his own soldiers, and beyond them Sergeant Erb, and then the rest of them, Pelion, Badan Gruk, Cinta, Gauntai, and the heavies falling in wherever they felt like it. He stepped in behind Shortnose. The man had a way of wandering off, as if forgetting which squad he'd joined, but now he was here, trudging along under a massive bundle of rolled chain armor, weapons, and shield. The heavy had tied a Naruk finger bone to his beard, and it made a thumping sound on his chest as he walked. His maimed shield hand was bound up in leather straps. As they walked, the regulars to either side began converging ahead, as if to line their route, as if to watch in that hood-damned silence of theirs as the marines and heavies passed. His unease deepened.
Not a word from them, not a thing, as if we're strangers.
As the troop approached the broad avenue, the only sound came from their marching, the hard impact of their boots and the clatter of equipment. And through his growing anger, Cuttle had an uncanny sensation of walking through an army of ghosts as the regulars drew up on either side. He didn't see a single youthful face among all the onlookers.
And not a nod, not even a tilt of a head. But we look just as old and ruined, don't we? What are they seeing? What are they thinking? Tavaray, I don't envy you, these soldiers. I can't read them at all. Do they understand? Have they worked it out yet? They're heading east to block the army the Asael are sending after us, to buy us the time we need. But if they can't do it, if they can't slow the bastards down, it's all lost. This whole damned thing falls apart. You're headed for a fight, and we won't be there for you, any of you. No fist of heavies, no knots of marines in the line. So if that's a look of betrayal in your faces, if you think all this is about abandoning all of you, then Hood take me.
The thought ended abruptly, and Cuttle's growing anger simply disintegrated. The regulars began saluting, fists to their chests, standing at attention in suddenly perfect rows to either side. The few muttered conversations among the marines and heavies fell off, and suddenly the silence became oppressive in an entirely different way. Cuttle felt more than heard the company's footfalls slipping into cadence, and in the squad directly in front of him he now saw the soldiers edging into paired rows behind Captain Fiddler, with Korab and Tar in the lead, Smiles and Korik behind them, followed by Bottle and Shortnose.
You just had to be uneven, growled Balm in a low voice as he came up on his right. Then drop back and shake this out all over again. Can't even remember the last time I found myself on a parade. No, we just hold this sapper and hope to Hood no one trips over their own hood damned feet. Wasn't expecting this. I hate it. I feel sick. Where are we going again? Stop panicking, Sergeant. And who in the white jackal's name are you, soldier?
Cuttle sighed.
Just march, Sergeant. Once we get through this, we can relax again. Promise.
We getting medals or something? No, this is something else. This is what the adjunct said wouldn't happen. Look at these regulars. They're witnessing us.
Did you see this?
Kissware asked. Cinta kept staring straight ahead, but she frowned.
What do you mean? Your visions. Did you see any of this? And what about what's coming? What about tomorrow or the next day?
It's not like that.
Her sister sighed.
Funny. I can see what's coming. Right through to the very end.
No, you can't. That's just fear talking.
And it's got a lot to say.
Just leave it, Kissware.
No, I won't. Tell me about a vision of the future, with us in it. Here's mine. You've got a baby on your hip, with a boy running ahead. It's the morning walk down to the Imperial School, the one they were building before we left. And I got a girl who looks just like me, but wild, a demon in disguise. We're exhausted, in the way of all mothers, and I'm getting fat. We brag about the runts, complain about our husbands, bitch at how tired we are. It's hot, the flies are out, and the air smells of rotted vegetables. Husbands. When are they going to finish fixing the roof? That's what we want to know. When instead of doing something useful, the lazy bastards spend all day lying in the shade picking their noses. And then if that's not...
Stop it, Kissware.
To Cinta's astonishment, her sister fell silent.
Was that the first time? Must have been. Sorido, the miller's boy. I'd woken up that morning with tits. We went behind the old custom house annex, on that burnt stubble where they'd toasted an infestation of spiders only a few days before, and I lifted up my shirt and showed them off. What was that boy's name? Rilt? Rallet? His eyes got huge. I'd stolen a flask from the house. Peach brandy. You could set your breath on fire with that stuff. I figured he needed loosening up. Good knows I did. So we drank and he played with them. I had to fight him to get his cock out. And that was the first time. Wish there'd been a thousand more, but it didn't work out that way. He was killed a year later in his father's shop. Some rushed order on ship fittings. Rumours of another crackdown on Cartuli pirates because the Malazan overlords were losing revenues or something. They weren't pirates. That's just a name for people being obvious about theft. There could have been other boys, dozens of them. But who wants to lie down on the ground on an island crawling with deadly spiders? Rallet or Ralt or whatever your name was. I'm glad we fucked before you died. I'm glad you had at least that. It's not fair how the years just vanish.
I love you, Helion. How hard could it be to just say those words? But even thinking them made Herb's jaw tighten as if bound in wire. Sudden sweat under his armor, a thudding heart, a sickening sensation of nausea in his throat. She had never looked better. No, she was beautiful. Why wasn't he the drunk? Then he could blather out all he wanted to say in that shameless way drunks had. But why would she want him then, unless she was just as drunk? But she wasn't anything like that now. Her eyes were clear, and they never rested, as if she was finally seeing things, and all that slackness was gone from her face, and she could probably have any man she wanted now, so why bother looking at him? He kept his gaze ahead, trying not to notice all these regular soldiers with their salutes. Better to pretend they weren't even there, weren't paying them any attention, and they could walk out of this army, off to do whatever it was that needed doing, and no one needed to notice anything. Attention made him nervous when the only attention he really wanted was from her. But if she gave it to him, he'd probably fall to pieces.
I'd like to make love. Just once before I die. I'd like to hold her in my arms and feel as if the world's just slid and shifted into its proper shape, making everything perfect. And I could see all of that right there in her eyes. And looking up, I'd see all these soldiers saluting me. No, that's not right. Don't look up, Herb. Listen to yourself. idiot.